Do you want the title?
The first one I'm going to read.
I'm writing this from my mother's apartment.
It's called Orange.
All I could think about was being written into her life story.
She made up a story back.
What was the inspiration for the story?
My story is called Cigarettes.
What was the genesis?
I used to be almost dependent
Dear B,
on voice.
A speaker and a poll.
I want to talk to you.
And the conversation starts.
Hello, and welcome to Off the Page, a podcast featuring the fiction, poetry, and creative nonfiction of the Stanford writing community. In each episode, a writer will read from their work and then have a conversation about the craft behind the creation. I'm your host, Mark Lebowski, Jones Lecturer in the Creative Writing Program at Stanford. Jalen Utsi is a 2022 to 2024 Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford University. His poems have appeared in Best New Poets 2022, Nashville Review, Poetry Northwest, Harper Palette, and the Hopkins Review.
The first poem is titled West Prine, Florida. Bare, bird-chested boys play touch football in the street, reenact WrestleMania in the fenced-in front yard. When an errant pass rocks a mailbox, the whole block takes off running. After the game that never ends is paused, a swarm of sweaty boys meander to the corner store to buy a pickled egg or a hot sausage. At Galvez and B Seafood, they call the woman working behind the counter mommy and order kunk fritters with french fries, squeeze lemon juice over the kunk, crisscrossing ketchup and mustard over the juice. Here, in this cutout between Hemingway's Key West home and Jenkins' moonlight, gunfire dapples the far-off night. One day, a man in a black Mercedes will inch up alongside you and ask, "You working?" "Nah." "You want to work?" "Nah." House guests. My mother has two house guests. Her house guests, two children, make a mess of the living room. Make a brimming biome of an oriental red. Hand-tufted, wool, and littered with animals. Minuscule, plush, bean-filled, and breaking. The older child is a sweet, sensitive, clever little nightmare. She is afraid of the dark and worships her father. They talk on the phone for hours. She is bright and deceitful like an orchid mantis. The younger one puts her hand out, opening and closing it whenever she sees food. "Gimme," says the soft palm, the short fingers. "Gimme," says the panting dog, scratching at a dust-brown bowl, hard plastic and empty. My mother has two house guests, not unlike plants or bees, never far from sunlight and honey. There is a drawer full of juice pouches. Below them, different bottles with different caps, a jar of Enfamil. Beneath the brown sectional and at my mother's feet, a small cardboard staircase, nearly weightless, made for a small dog with a history of knee problems. Above the staircase, the dog. Smooth, sheeny, and brown, curls up like a waxing gibbous with pointy ears, sleeping. To my caring and worried mother, there are sliced carrots in the shape of a cowbell because I understand great food should sing to you. There's a novel about Alzheimer's and some magic memory pills for grandma. There's an automatic food dispenser so you don't have to feed the dogs anymore. There's a travel bag with a Bible and a plane ticket to Paris. There's a color-coded flowchart describing the best way to carry a conversation with grandma. In the bottom right-hand corner, in fine print, it explains you may have to adopt new tactics on the fly. I caught grandma watching The Hulk in Spanish today. I just flipped to the English version. To my caring and worried mother, raising your voice won't help. There is no cure. All the post-it notes on all the cabinet should say, open with caution, eat with intensity, Remember, we love you and will help you find the watch you stuffed in the cookie jar. West Perrine Park, the big park, and there's an epigraph by the sports writer Howard Bryant that reads, "It gave these black men their poetry." A white boy asked me to walk him to the bathroom before a baseball game at a public park where my father was once pseudonymed Myth. He ate the snake and a generation of Hellcats, Pee-wee, Crow, Romy, Termite, and others, had been good for pockets and bad for business as fans won ends on the weekend, betting and rooting for the home team. Everyone in their Easter Sunday, straight from the pew, alabaster best or home whites, swaying behind home plate and sprinkled down the right field line like seafoam teasing the shore, then decided to opt out of the grinding march of money-making come Monday. What the boys seemed too afraid to understand was that all the men crowding around the teal, worn metal bleachers behind the dugout were arguing about the Dolphins or playing the dozens or sipping grape soda or rolling bones, or narrating the sweat ballet unfurling atop the two-tone green and pink-red basketball court, and all those men would soon be rooting for him because he was wearing orange and green. What was unseen were the titan black backs of the men who built the field he could now extend his dreams on. I think he homered that day, rounding the bases with a surprised smile as the Hellcats of old tapered a fade or faded from memory. He always played better on this hallowed ground he couldn't divorce from phantom echoes of bullets and blood. I walked the boy across the second, unused court to the bathroom, our metal cleats tapping a tune of pregame buzz and jitters while a mother weaved box braids into her daughter's hair down the left field line, and the memories of a milkman with no milk hung like fog in the air around the backstop. Bubblegum Stadium, they called it. Rainbow City. This poem came out of a revision and kind of came out of my interest in what public housing looks like in different parts of the country. In Miami, especially in this case, it's pastel and brightly colored. Rainbow City. Three shirtless boys walk the tightrope of a wall, faces shadowed by a willow. They teeter atop a tightrope, a bed of dew-wet blades beneath. Three shirtless boys dance on the white-trimmed lip, nearing the exactness needed to fly. They trickle along the wall like scurrying blue crabs, lovesick for the sea. Propped atop this ripe peach border, they dangle their legs over the ledge as their sweat-slick skin beams above passing cars. I drive by, blink them miniature. They play lookout for no one. They float above the street, thirsting for a quarter water. They talk about chocolate cities and the scent of a beach rarely seen. They kick their heels against a pastel past no better than the blackened present. This poem is titled Snuff, and that's a term for smokeless tobacco. My dad chews tobacco and chewed tobacco when I was growing up. Snuff. My daddy packed a pinch of Skoal Mint, sexier than most things I've seen women do. Once, he offered me and my adolescent tongue a taste out of some old-school, parochial sense of education. Let the rod of experience thunder loud and profound where the lips might only whisper unintentional invitations. Like the clued-in June bug I was, I heard alarm bells blaring behind my eyes, blind with admiration. I decided simply to watch and marvel at the way my daddy carried himself with so much swagger, the way he kept a Diet Pepsi bottle in his back pocket stuffed with paper towels and dip spit, as cool as the coldest mink on the coat rack. I settled for a different red and black map of imitation, a can of Jack Link's beef chew, fattened my lip with the finely ground meat and juice, slipped the faux snuff into the back pocket of my baseball pants with scandalous intent as if it was the plastic foil O of a condom wrapper, leaning into my little secret, the lead up to my big joke, my wry smile and reveal. My daddy's vice as beautiful as a well-made blade. The astringent mint making Jean's nicotine sing, setting the gums ablaze. He quit and unquit, and I learned what you can and can't make of a man. But one day, on the red clay of Black Miami, where the diamonds go mostly unused, I got bit by a wasp while fielding ground balls. My father took the wet contents of his bottom lip and pressed it to the bite, stemming the pain and swelling. I got to return to one of baseball's cherished rhythmic routines. Catch, step, and pitch it to first. Field service. As a boy, I went door to door with my mother and grandmother. At first, I only knocked, played my part as mascot. My mother, thinner then before three knee surgeries, and my grandmother, always wearing her straw hat, they did the talking when I was a boy. My mother, firm and intimidating, greeted every open door with a wide smile and two magazines, Watchtower and Awake. I remember the clip-on ties, penny loafers, and small leather briefcase my mother bought so I could look the part. I can't quite remember when I first started to speak at the door, wave my hand at the homeowners. "We bring you good news," I must have said. This next one is titled Surprise Visit. Mangoes ripening in a wicker basket, tough and green. You could skin them and eat them with salt. In the oven, the softening flesh of salmon, waiting to be pulled out and served with yellow grits and butter. My mother was away when two visitors came knocking. What I can describe is the powder blue, chalk-outlined hopscotch box, beginning with your first step off the fading beige front porch so that you could jump or drop into play the way you might slip into a riff of your granddaddy's country twang and wisdom. What I can describe is the flaking floral porch column and brown coir welcome mat, rough to the touch of bare feet, or, if for some reason, the sensitive skin of the cheek. My cousin lived in the fenced-in house across the street before he slept on our couch. His mother lived next door in a sea-level duplex with a small backyard and a metal line used to air-dry damp clothes. She was alive when the visitors came, or she wasn't. All I have is one good shoulder, two good feet, and memory. The elementary school field trip where I eased out to the bathroom, then quenched my thirst at the water cooler while the other kids cheesed and marveled at the fingerprinting process. I think they used black ink, black like these visitors' uniforms. I tell these men the man they seek never lived here, has left no valuables or products, no secrets but the mystery of his brief life. When they demanded a more senior presence, my grandmother cracked the door a little wider and spoke with the detachment of a disembodied voice. We do not speak to the dead. It's against our beliefs. We do not trifle with ghosts, even ones we birthed. Dégringolade. This slow, souring, so dumb, so demented, the body bent toward a break, the mind unmending, a dented domino effect, affectless, no dominion over demeanor, dearth, demon in the tawdry dome, tamed to a T, dormant tenant in a dungeon, dentured and denatured, answering only to one demand. Sonnet. In the dream of the life you did or did not live, disease spins eddies in the blood of your kin, and bullets do what they will in the dark. Yet the repast still smells of fried catfish and ham hocks. Someone must make a run for more hot sauce. In the dream that is memoir, you died before king tide swept through the city and reshaped coastline and inland escape without bias. Before anyone could solve the brutal mystery of blue. You never gave Maggie Nelson the time of day. What about gray, the brain's subtle decay? Another coast left lifeless, left longing in rank silence. This one is titled Flight to Portland. The head flight attendant is a whip of a man, tall and southern, his brisk walk only bested by the tempo of his tongue. His quick wit, I suspect, is both weapon and shield. From what, I wonder? The flitter in his voice when he says down makes an older gentleman chuckle and reminisce on a past lover. All of us on this full flight have named him, I'm sure. Boy Wonder, Rude Boy, Waylon, maybe. I'm a flight attendant. I've had it all, he says. Any other questions? This poem is titled Hypnosis and came to be because I believe not too long ago there was a green comet that was visible in the bay, and a friend of mine mentioned that we could see it, and it turned out we were like a day late, so. Hypnosis. Sachi teases us with a green comet we cannot see. Young and her cloying love stories close behind her. Astronomy, physiology, and optical illusions. You could seduce a would-be lover with this knowledge. What do you believe in? I'm still building, I say. The apple frangipanes in the oven. The iridologist appointment is scheduled for early April. Stepping down from the covered couch to the faded Afghan, she undoes her tan, oversized hoodie. A clever hypnotist has freed her from a cat allergy. Mother's Visit. I loop to and through domestic arrivals until the conveyor belt of baggage finally frees Mother from its hold. This is an interesting apartment, she says. She suggests a new styling cream, soap containers, another towel rack, and this all before diagramming the moisture retention of pine. She forgets her charger. She forgets her toothbrush. She remembers an unspoken half-joke. I hope the seatbelt fits around me. We hope to meet up with Dan and his father. We hope to meet up with Dora and Kyle and their two kids. I've been reading about chosen families and a crisis of connection. Mother alludes to the God-sized hole in my life. My poems, my poems, my poems. They grow on her like the apartment does. And this will be the last one. It's titled Urbane. I wake with the children and their oversized dogs. The landscape is the French braid and urban sprawl. Semiotics is the prevailing religion. You must tip your baker now. Ennui is a zip code, but the gardens are spreading. The dogs overrun the aisles, taste testing the tomatoes and bell peppers. They know something we don't about gut health and nuclear waste. Yes, this is a catalog of dispatches from the deep. This is a postmodern novel. I'm a man at sea. I'm suffering myself to love you. Isn't that brave?
Hey, Dylan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thank you for being here on Off the Page and sharing your work with us. I'm going to start with a really, really specific, silly question. Jack Lynx makes a beef chew? Like, it's supposed to be simulated.
I don't know if it's supposed to be simulated chewing tobacco, but it does come in the same sort of can, and it's like, you know, shredded, chopped up in like very small amounts. So yeah, I bought a can of that as a kid playing baseball and like put it in my mouth and put it in my back pocket, which was really the show-offy part. And I think my dad told me to take it out of my pocket just so he didn't think that someone on the team that he was coaching slash his kid was like chewing tobacco at like 16 years old or 14 years old, whatever age I was.
That's, I mean, I've had a lot of Jack Lynx like jerky in my life. I didn't realize there was also a chew product. That was just that detail.
Yeah, it's out there. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Miami. I feel like sometimes products are regional, so maybe me and the other degenerates in Florida, we've got the chew products.
I'm curious, just jumping off from that, as someone who writes about, or it seems like you write about home and childhood and memory and remembered spaces and places. Do you find a poem starts with a very particular detail or image that's snagged in the memory, or is it more closer to something you hear, like a tonality or a phrase, or what would you say is like the most common origin point?
Yeah, that's a good question. I remember Mary Ruffel saying one time that all her poems begin in her head, like not on the page. And that's not exactly true for me, but I do think sometimes it's true. The poem West Bryant Park, The Big Park, that poem definitely began in my head. I was like washing dishes and then I got like the first line and I just followed the rhythm for as long as I could. And I had to like stop washing dishes to go like write it down. And I always say that you follow the rhythm for as long as you can. And a poem like that, it carried me basically through the entire poem. But a lot of times following the rhythm is just a stanza or a line or two, and then I've got to figure out how to pivot. Yeah, I don't really know how it starts, you know. Sometimes poems are revised over a span of years. Sometimes they're written in 30 minutes and then revised ever so slightly over the next few months, just honing it. Memory certainly plays a big part. In talks with other writer friends of mine, I'm sort of jealous of folks who aren't as reliant on memory, who have a research practice. Maybe they're working in an archive. They're sort of distanced from the self, and maybe they're not using the eye as often. So I'm sort of jealous of that, but I think a lot of my work is rooted in memory. But I think I'm often trying to figure out, like, what is a poem and what I have to say or what I remember and what in the language that I enjoy hearing can be made into a poem. Yeah.
Well, thinking of that question of like, what is a poem, that made me wonder, like, how much does form, and I don't even necessarily mean like a traditional form, but just sort of like, I'm thinking of the one To My Mother, which I found was so interesting because although it seems to be about the grandmother and what she's dealing with, it's framed as the speaker addressing his mother. So it's kind of this indirect lens on the situation. And I'm thinking of that, and I'm thinking of Surprise Visit also, which took me by surprise in the way that its focus sort of shifted from this kind of nostalgic childhood tableau to this threat at the door. I'm curious, does a form like that, or maybe that's not the right word, but sort of a shape or container, does that arrive with the subject matter, or is that something that the subject or the content would lead you toward in the writing process?
I think the form or the structure is often a result of revision. I think my weakness as a writer is probably structure and form, and so I have a little bit of experience as a pseudo-journalist, and the edits I get back are almost always structural. So I think the thing that I feel most confident about is language and musicality. And that's the part that's most fun for me, the sort of like jazz, spontaneous creation, the sort of vomit draft that allows your mind to go all over the place. And so that's the part that I really try to focus on. And then, you know, I sort of reluctantly accept that my first draft is not going to be the best draft and I have to continuously go back to the page to revise it. I think it's something in your question about, like you said, I don't know if it's form, but like how to like allow the poem to turn is interesting. I think oftentimes when you're writing, you're just trying to figure out how to get to the turn, how not to lose the reader when you make that turn. And as far as To My Caring and Worried Mother, I think that sort of like slanted lens came about pretty naturally because in some sense, the greatest tension in that situation, my grandma was dealing with dementia, was really between how other people react to someone dealing with dementia, because to some extent, you can't control the way the person who's dealing with the disease is behaving. And so really the tension starts to become how other people deal with it and how they interact with one another. In some sense, like heartbreakingly, I'm like sort of asking my mom to, yeah, you know, raising your voice isn't going to help in this situation, unfortunately, you know. But also like there's so much care in that, like raising of the voice, there's so much being lost. Obviously, anyone who's dealt with that situation knows you're sort of like watching someone disappear before your eyes. And I think probably also almost as defense mechanism and as like craft tool, the closer I think I look to the thing, the more the language sort of loses its poetry, becomes quite difficult to write about. I remember John Keane said it took him a long time. He wrote a poem, I believe, about the Pulse shooting, and it's like a list poem. And he said, for a long time, my emotions outstripped my language. So sometimes it takes a while for you to find the language to write about something.
Yeah. I feel like in a lot of your poems, especially the ones about Florida, about home, there's sort of this tension, or there's this combination of sort of like lyricism and danger, or like nostalgia and threat, or something like that. I'm thinking, in fact, of the first one you read, West Pride, Florida, which starts with these really beautiful images of boys playing and food, and then moves into, speaking of turns, moves into gunfire and who I interpreted as drug dealers. Mm-hmm. And there are a few other poems that I think have that a similar tension, including Surprise Visit. I'm curious, like, that tension, is that something that you're conscious of when you're writing the poem?
The Surprise Visit poem came about pretty naturally in Louise's workshop last year. She gave us a prompt to write a poem about, basically, have there be some sort of a small violence, which violence is interpreted sort of pretty expansively here, but like some small violence that is not mentioned in the poem, but is sort of the subject of the poem or influencing the poem. And so I think that allowed me to write about this situation that happened, you know, these police officers coming to my house, searching for someone who's no longer alive. It just seemed very odd, very shady. And I had never really like been able to write about it before. And I think that prompt of a small violence that's not central to the scene allowed me to get at that kind of strangeness of that experience. And I think strangeness is like maybe what I'm trying to get at. You know, I haven't seen the last two seasons, but the TV show Atlanta is like of interest of mine. I studied briefly like some of the French surrealist poets when I was in undergrad. And I think there's kind of like a wave right now in popular culture of the Afro-surreal, Black surrealism, especially in TV. And I think what that is like catching on is a kind of surreality to like American life. A police officer showing up asking you where a deceased loved one is and asking you if they left anything at the house, you know, a surreality to being asked if you want to work, which is like metaphor for selling drugs. But also you not really being in danger in any way. I had a backpack on and I was walking to school. I think that was the mix up. And I just went about my day and went to school and nothing happened. So I think what I'm trying to get at is strangeness a lot there. I'm really interested in this idea that like it's quite hard to encapsulate or understand someone else's life. Like, I think when I read some of those poems, people think, oh, very like stereotypical, you know, Black life in America. Poverty, danger, bullets, crime, etc., which is not really my experience. You know, I've gone to like magnet schools my entire life. I don't know. I've had a pretty easy life, I would say, all things told. But I'm certainly Black in America. I'm certainly don't come from an extreme amount of wealth. I'm like adjacent to a lot of things. Just that strangeness is what I'm trying to get at.
What would you say is your relationship in your writing or in your life to nostalgia? I think about that line from Rainbow City, a pastel past no better than the black and present. That line really sung out to me. And I'm curious, like in writing these poems that are so lushly detailed and in the present tense, but about the past and about childhood and about your hometown, like how do you grapple with the concept of nostalgia? Mm-hmm.
I think I'm prey to nostalgia just as much as anyone else, but I think maybe I'm nostalgic for something that other people are not nostalgic for in the poems. You know, I'm nostalgic for like a sense of community. I think that's also what I'm getting at in a lot of the poems about West Perrine is a sense of a grounding sense of community. And I'm not nostalgic for like the fact that, you know, this public housing unit has a pink wall around it, which is meant, of course, to hide something, to hide the living conditions of those inside the public housing unit. I mentioned before I read that poem, you know, like in Miami, there's a pink wall around this public housing unit. On the Northeast, it's like these towers, right? Public housing, you can't really see inside the towers, you know? So again, there's that impulse to kind of hide something, hide maybe the failures of a government to provide for its citizens, provide opportunity, et cetera, whatever you want to draw from it. But I'm sort of like, I don't know if I'm nostalgic, but I'm interested in those boys. And that poem came about, as I said, a revision of a poem that I didn't read called Summer, which I found just fascinating, these kids walking on this pink wall and that it was cracking. And then I did a workshop and Monica Yoon asked me, what do the boys think about their situation, about their life? I was like sort of uncomfortable with trying to answer that question. I'm very wary of like trying to speak for anyone besides myself. But I tried to answer it in giving them agency and saying, like, they play lookout for no one, you know, like, they're not a pawn in some, like, game. They're sort of their own people living their own lives.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking of what you said a little while ago about being, you know, adjacent to certain things, but not necessarily in them, and how your nostalgia might be different from the people you write about. And I realized that in some of these poems, like, the speaker is actually not super invoked. Some of them actually do seem very much like journalism or like portraiture. Do you think consciously at any point about how much you are going to be or not be in any individual poem?
I don't really think about it ahead of time. I mean, it's funny that you say that, because these days I feel like everything I write, the I is so central. And I think those poems were written at a time where I was in my MFA or right out of my MFA, and I had been reading a lot of Elizabeth Bishop, who famously keeps herself out of the poem, or kept herself out of the poem, to the point of being accused of sort of being frigid or like stunted emotionally, and people wanting more from her in that regard. And she was a very influential poet for me in my life as a poet. She sort of taught me how to stay on one topic for the length of a poem. Like I said, I studied some French surrealists in undergrad, and I had a habit of just like jumping around all over the place in the poem, these associative leaps. And then I read Elizabeth Bishop, and I was like, oh, okay, this is how you like describe one thing for the length of the poem and stick on one topic. So I think it's a tool, I guess, that I have. I would like to get back to it a little more often, I think, these days. But I told my Leventhal all this, but I feel like I sort of go comatose when I sit down to write. I go into a fugue state, and I don't know what comes out, what is what comes out. And I think that's why like reading ahead of time is so important, just like being an avid reader, so that when you go into that weird fugue state, what comes out is informed by history and language of other people and thinking of other people.
Since you mentioned it, it seems like now maybe you're writing more about your contemporary life, and there's the poem about the mother's visit and the green comet. What have been some of the challenges and also joys and opportunities you've discovered writing more present-day material?
Yeah, I don't know if this is made up or not, but I've been thinking a lot about how to get to the communal through the personal. And it feels like the communal is more obvious, or more obviously signaled almost inherently, in the poems about Miami, about place and race and the way those sorts of things intersect. And in the poems that are more personal, I think maybe making it clear that the speaker is aware that there is a world outside of themselves and their immediate experience is more difficult. And yeah, I think just giving the poems a certain amount of weight is maybe what I worry about. How to get to the communal in those poems, I think, is something I struggle with and think about. The joys, I guess, is that they can just come from experience more naturally, maybe, and that they don't require a long lead-up time to write them.
So, Elizabeth Bishop, French surrealists, what other poets have been formative?
Terence Hayes, Ross Gay, Mary Ruffel. I've read a lot of Hanif Abdurraqib, who is more sort of nonfiction writer than poet, but sometimes I find myself trying to write almost like a nonfiction essay in the form of a poem, and I think there's a lot of influence there from him. Denez Smith, they're another poet who I've read pretty extensively. Been trying to read some Francis Punge, sort of prose poems. Paul Beattie, also poet and fiction writer, but his book, The Sellout, is, I don't know if it's an influence, you know, I don't even know, think I want to go as far as saying that, but it's a book I really enjoy.
I have a question. Why did you choose this body of work to share with us today?
I mean, I guess the simple answer is more of the best poems that I have. So that's the easy answer, just, I guess, putting my best foot forward. I also think trying to show a sense of progression, kind of moving from the poems of boyhood, place, race, to like more contemporary stuff. Things that are sort of implicating the self and like looking at the self. So trying to maybe envision for myself a progression that would fit into a manuscript.
Where do you feel like you're at with your manuscript, and how are things going there?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm trying to figure out how to shape a manuscript while at the same time trying to write more good poems that I can feel confident being in the book and, you know, having my name above them. So putting a book together, I think, is a different skill set than like writing an individual poem. And I'm learning that skill set. I'm learning the difficulty of like putting a book together. I'm kind of learning what art requires of you being an artist, that I may have to get more uncomfortable and reveal things I don't want to reveal, or go deeper into subjects that I thought I may have already like addressed to the point of exhaustion. So yeah, I think that's what I'll say about a book.
There got to be a point where you're like, well, I kind of like have to write a poem about X or Y to sort of go into that space.
Yeah, I think people always say that, and I'm sure that's true, like true for me as well. It just feels like that's the thing that I've been running away from, I guess. So to a certain extent, I think, you know, a lot of the early poems that I read are the ones that have garnered a lot of interest, the ones that have been published. And there's a sense that, like, maybe that's a thing that people want to see more of from me. But there's also a sense for me being like, I think I've already said what I have to say, at least for now, and that it would require me to, again, to veer in a more, like, circuitous path to get to some of these subjects again. And I don't think I've quite figured out the method of doing that. What they don't tell you, I guess, is that sometimes it's hard figuring out what exactly is the thing you need to write to fill in the gaps in the manuscript. So maybe they're like a few steps ahead of me.
Do you think there are things that like the poetry world expects specifically you to write that you don't want to write or maybe have feel like you've exhausted?
I think that it's important that I say, to some extent, I probably just need to write better poems and more of them. You know, I think I'm definitely in the Elizabeth Bishop camp of like not writing as many poems as I should. You know, I'm not someone who writes every day, and that if I wrote more poems, maybe some of this would take care of itself. And then on top of that, I guess I'll say trying to teach the reader how to engage with a different type of poem is something that I've been wrestling with. I don't actually think my poems are all that surreal, despite like the influence of like surrealist poets like André Breton, Robert Desnos. But there is a way sometimes where you get feedback from someone where something is not registering and you're trying to figure out where the discrepancy is. Like maybe you lost the person on the turn. I don't know. To some extent, maybe it's just you need a good idea. And then the language that I have, like I said, I think I'm confident on the language on like a line level. The language that I have that is strong can be applied to something that has that weight that I talked about before.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Off the Page is produced in partnership with the Stanford Storytelling Project and the Creative Writing Program. Special thanks to Jonah Willingans, the director of the Stanford Storytelling Project, and Patrick Phillips, Christina Ablaza, and Danielle Huliganga of the Creative Writing Program. For their generous support, we'd like to thank the Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education, Stanford Arts, and Bruce Braden. This episode was produced by Alex Strong, Megan Kalfas, and Laura Joyce Davis. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. For more Stanford writing, author events, and workshops, visit creativewriting.stanford.edu. You can find this and other episodes of Off the Page at storytelling.stanford.edu or anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'm Mark Lebowski. Thanks for listening.